Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I've been told by our people who post these on the website to say what today is so they know they're getting the right one. So today is the 16th of July as we do another part of my never-ending memories. Okay. Talked a lot about the prayer book. Oh, I need to turn this on. Prayer book revision, and as I said last week, I hope I said it and made it clear at least in some way that one of the greatest privileges I've had in my entire life, and certainly as a priest, was to get to be a fly on the wall who managed to actually get in the either the honey or the ointment. A lot with that prayer book revision stuff. And it was, I'm still deeply thankful that I was in the right spot when the right people were there to say, hey, let's make him do some stuff. And there were times when I just sort of also said, wouldn't you like me there again? And they would graciously say yes. So it was nice. My own experience, I've been the priest at a number of different kinds of churches. The old days in the Diocese of Dallas, when you were ordained like Deacon Shea, the very first thing that the bishop did was stick you in a struggling mission church somewhere, usually so far away that you couldn't get very good TV reception, and that's the days when it was an aerial on top of your house, you know. And I was sent out to St. John the Divine in Burke Burnett, Texas, the name of which which congregation was much longer than the size of the congregation, as a deacon, which meant I had to do the service up to the offertory, which then the prayer book requires be done from there on by a priest, and we would all hold our breath that Father Russell from St. Stephen's Parish, who oversaw me, would get there in time to do Lift Up Your Hearts. And sometimes we sort of delayed and, you know, is he going to get here or not? And then he would show up. It was a small congregation, 40 people. And fortunately, almost all of them came to church because they knew if they didn't, something might happen that they would miss. And over half were attached to, this is still in the height of the Cold War, so over half of those were living in Burke Burnett because it was a bedroom community to Shepherd Air Force Base, a strategic air command base, as Vicki will remember. She grew up in that part of the world. And one of the biggest challenges of that congregation was that about every 6 to 9 months, a sizable contingent of Air Force personnel, and therefore their wives and families, would be relocated to another part of the world. So I'd been there 7, 8 months. I'd met Cherry, and we'd gotten married, and we moved into the newly built little rectory next to the church. The whole church sat and the rectory sat in a wheat field. We used to have the combine harvesting during June, coming by the open windows because we didn't have air conditioning. So you'd be preaching and just stop for a minute and let the wheat dust waft through the windows, and when it settled, then we would go on. About early March, bang, half the congregation were being transferred out. And the next word was, oh, we don't have enough income to pay you. And the word went to Bishop Mason, said, I don't care, I put him there, he has to stay there till he does his time. He was a saint, but he was one of those hard saints. He was a martyr and he deserved it. Is that better, Father Roper? The archdeacon said to him, who oversaw this stuff, and the new suffragan bishop, said to Bishop Mason, but they can't pay him. And the bishop said, I don't care. That's the way it is. They're going to have to find the money. Tell them that they've got to find the money. And they said, well, Bishop, half their people have been transferred out. Nope, that's the way it's going to be. But the Suffragan bishop's wife, a woman named, he was Bishop Barnes, and his wife's name was Ida Lou. Ida Lou was a woman of some strong opinions. And they looked over us, particularly because I was ordained by Bishop, a priest by Bishop Barnes, the day after he was turned into a bishop. So they were deeply invested. And one day Ida Lou got in her little car of some sort and motored across from Fort Worth, where they lived, to Dallas, down to the bishop's office on Main Street, and went up and walked in the bishop's office and said, Avery, I have to talk to you. And she said, you... Because by that time, there was a little mission church that has just become a parish over in Garland. And they wanted me to be their priest. And she said, I want to talk to you. They can't pay Michael Merriman. He's a good priest. And you've got to let him go over to Garland. And so he did. And
that was after he told us that, well, they could live on spaghetti. That's what I did.
No. He said, we're paying you $300 a month. You know, he said, Virginia and I lived on $100 a month. And I said, well, yeah, it was the height of the Depression.
And Jesus was a boy.
Right. So from there, I went to St. Barnabas, and actually they had gotten one of Bishop Mason's, any priest will do if he can walk and talk. And he had stuck somebody over in that mission church in Garland, and he was killing the parish. He excommunicated the Episcopal church women. I'm not kidding. They pissed him off, so he excommunicated them. And, so they went to the bishop and said, you've got to get this guy out. And he said, well, the only way you can get him out is if you raise enough money to become an independent parish and call your own rector. So they went back, and with the help of, anybody here remember? A parish treasurer named Jim McGowan.
Oh, yes. Right.
Who became a member of this parish. When I came back here in 2004, there was Jim and Pat McGowan, who were among the youngsters at St. Barnabas. And Jim, and he and I used to laugh back once we reestablished. We cooked the books and made it look like we had enough money. Or they did. I wasn't there yet. And my first trial was discovered, we don't really have as much money as we said we did, but we're going to do our best. But it was a congregation in a little brick building that looked like a shoebox with a church tower, because churches have to have towers that the parishioners had built themselves out of 2x4s and 4x8 plywood. And it looked like a milk carton. It's, you know... People said it looked like a shoebox with a milk carton beside it. And that blew down finally, thanks be to God. But we had, once I reestablished and recommunicated the Episcopal Church, when we had 75 members. And here's what was interesting. Cherry and I were in our 20s. And there were only 5 people in the parish who were over 50. Everybody else was in their 20s and early 30s, just they're in their starter homes, having little babies like everything. Half our congregation were under the age of 12. We burst out of that building and had to build a new building. We had to cook the books again to persuade the bishop we could afford to build a new building. We couldn't, but we did, and we paid for it. It was exciting, and we had these 5 older people. I thought they were elderly at the time. The oldest was 65. But people who were 65 in those days were a lot older than they are today. Any of you notice that? They really were a lot older. But anyhow, so that, and we grew, and things went well, and it was great. And then I moved off. That's when I took off to be a consultant for liturgical education, to promote the prayer book for a few years. And then when we came back here, the bishop asked me to go head up Camp Crucis, the diocesan camp, and to take care of the little mission church that they had started in Granbury. That's just when Granbury was about to become cute. I'm quite serious. Up until that point, if you drove around that cute square, the courthouse was falling apart and over half the buildings in the square were boarded up. It was empty, and then they built the lake, and then they built De Cordova Bend and Pecan Plantation, and a whole bunch of very prosperous people in their 60s and 70s and older moved out to live on the lake and play golf with people who were like them, so they wouldn't have to be like those people in Fort Worth and Dallas who weren't like them. And a significant number were Episcopalians, and they started the Church of the Good Shepherd. They had the retired priest who had been in charge of Camp Crucis, who I followed. So he was retired and old, and they were old, and it was lovely, and we were all alike, and we had a little tiny building, and we were just happy being what we were. And Cherry and I showed up. We were still just in our 30s. Oh, she wasn't. I was still in my 30s. The kid was still in her 20s. And there was one family our age with two children, and that was the Sunday school. And they were dying for change. No. It's so good to be in a church. It was so good when Father Reeves was here to be in a church where we had an older priest who wasn't spending all his time with those young people and those children and all of that. We just felt left out at All Saints Fort Worth and Trinity Fort Worth and St. John's Fort Worth and St. John's Dallas, because they had all these young people and they had these young priests, and they never paid attention to us older people. And it's so good that we're here. And I really didn't take that really well when they were saying that to me when I was 32. I'm not drawing any parallels, but with some of the stuff that people have been saying to me lately after it was announced that Deacon Liz and I were retiring. So don't take it to heart, other than it is my considered and experienced opinion that the future of Transfiguration, like every church, does not rest on the people who are over 60. That's not the topic of my speech, though. So. I said it would be opinionated, maybe. So, here we go. Bang. A lot of things happened there, and we started finding lots of families who wanted to join, because, like often the case, they have been beaten up and made to feel unhappy in fundamentalist or rigid Catholic communities, and they were happy to find the openness and welcome of the Episcopal Church. And I won some battles, it became a vigorous parish, and we became a parish, as a matter of fact, self-supporting parish, and with a Sunday school, had to build a Sunday school building, lots of stories with that, but I won't bother you with it. But it really became a healthy place and has been ever since, though the healthy half of it had to leave the building to stay with the Episcopal Church when the Bishop of Fort Worth took the old people off to the Anglican Church. And the old people's church is still out there in that building, and they're dying off. And the church, the Episcopal Church of the Good Shepherd in Granbury, was meeting in the late women's club of Granbury having to set up a room every Sunday to have services, and grew and stuff, and they've just bought 5 acres of land. They've raised $500,000 as seed money to build a new church, and part of that land is going to be retirement housing for older people sponsored by the church, and they're going great guns and stuff, while the old people with the old priest are over with the old church, called the Anglican Church of North America now, being church. Yay. Okay. So, that was fun, and I thought, Cherry and I really did think we were going to be there. We've started looking at building our own house. We've decided to buy one in the meantime, but we really want, people were building really cool, because we were into alternative stuff of the 70s, and people were building really cool, ecologically friendly log houses. And we helped two other people build their log cabins with, you know, wood stoves, so we didn't depend on man-made and bad fuels, and we had we were really cool, and it was so great. And then the Bishop of Dallas formed such a dislike of the changes in the Episcopal Church, particularly as his suffragan bishop pronounced it, women being ordained and stuff, that then the Bishop of Dallas had the bright idea to divide the diocese in two and have a diocese of Fort Worth and a diocese of Dallas. And he decided he would go over and be the Bishop of Fort Worth, where there were a lot of clergy in particular who didn't like women. That's how Bishop Terwilliger pronounced it, with a look on his face I wouldn't like to try to duplicate. No, don't get into personalities, Michael. Okay. Huh? Terwilliger. And I really said, you know, I'm not like Terry Roper, who's willing to stay here and fight the good fight. I don't want to fight, and I want to get out. So I started interviewing for parishes hither, thither, and yon and stuff, and thinking of one that was really entrancing in New Mexico, and one that was interesting in Maryland, and stuff like that. And in the midst of that, one of the refreshments I had was still to go to this group of diocesan liturgy and music chairs, and they were going to have their annual meeting in 1981 in Burlingame, just south of San Francisco, and I'd never been to San Francisco. I thought that would be really cool. She had, and I was jealous. And so I went to that meeting, and it was happening at Grace Cathedral part of the time. And I went, oh, wow, this is a cool place. Gee, wouldn't it be fun to be around here? Well, fat chance of that. It was a good conference, and we did a lot of good stuff there. And I went home and really got serious. The church in Santa Fe was really looking at me. I mean, Albuquerque was really looking at me seriously. And I got a letter from the dean of Grace Cathedral, who I had met, but I didn't remember meeting. And he said, we're looking for a precentor. That's what classically the priest in cathedrals who's in charge of music and liturgy is called, the title. We're looking for a canon precentor. And the canon headmaster of our boys' school knows you from seminary, and he says you might be interested in a couple of the priests who were at the liturgical conference, said you might be really good at that. And I went, well, cool. Yeah. Yeah, me? From a little church that seats 90 people at a service, so we had to have 4 on a weekend to get them all in. And, you know, out in West Texas, yeah, oh well, but we'd like to fly you out to San Francisco for interviews. I thought, well, I'll do that. So we did, and we had interviews, and I had a lovely time. It was just delightful, and the people were nice, and I flew home, and a week later, we'd like to offer you the job. And I said, ding, 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 Albuquerque, forget it. And so off we went. And it was an incredible time. I won't bore you with all of that, but there were some things that happened there that were of importance to the Episcopal Church, not just there, but I was able to be a witness and participant in things that were happening that were important for the whole Episcopal Church. And this is not a totally happy story. We drove out to San Francisco when we moved with two dogs and a cat. We spent one night on a drive in Needles, which I don't recommend as a vacation spot. But the next morning at breakfast, I picked up a L.A. Times and started reading it. And there was an article. I'd heard a little of this, but it didn't really register. But there was an article about that there not only appeared to be this strange, very rare pneumonia that was striking, for some reason, gay men, but now they had found an equally rare and uncommon cancer that was striking predominantly, almost exclusively, gay men. And they were talking about a gay cancer, and I thought, oh, wow. Now, I did know that San Francisco was noted for an openness to gay and lesbian life and that was uncommon outside of maybe also New York. I didn't know what that had to do with the Episcopal Church, for sure. Cherry and I ourselves had been part of that aspect of the Episcopal Church that welcomed gay and lesbian people, but understood the convention of yes, but we don't, we know, but we don't talk about it. Yeah. The Episcopal Church invented don't ask, don't tell a long time before the military did. So I fully expected that we would find our welcome was not quite like one of my colleagues at the cathedral. He and his wife came there, moved to San Francisco from South Carolina about 2 years before we did, and where they were staying temporarily till they got a house was in the Upper Mission district, and they drove also, and when they came into San Francisco, they were driving there, and they were going down Market Street, and they got to Castro Street, and there was a guy wearing cowboy boots and a gold lame G-string and a cowboy hat directing traffic, and and they all the way over, out there, George and Bonnie had been talking to each other, you know, we're going to encounter a lot of gay people, how do we prepare our 12-year-old daughter for this, so she, because she's been protected, and as they came by this, they were both looking at each other saying, well, and their daughter said, oh, look, there's one of those gay men. So George and Bonnie said, well, we don't have to explain much, so there. So our welcome wasn't like that, but we got there, and I was finding my way around this massive building with places, nooks and crannies and catwalks and stuff. I mean, you know, to go climbing around the catwalks 95 feet above the floor where you can watch everything and all of that. And, oh, just really cool. And I had a whole staff. I mean, I've been the only priest, the only staff member in two congregations, okay? And I got there, I had 12 people working for me. I had never had a budget higher than $30,000 to work with. I had a budget of $250,000 just for my part of the cathedral's operation. And I had a secretary. I didn't have to cut the stencils for the mimeograph machine myself. And one of my vergers, these are they're not ceremonial lay people who like to walk around pompously on Sunday like you see down at St. Matthew's Cathedral or someplace. But these were men and later a woman. I hired the very first female head verger in the Anglican Communion. What the vergers did, they unlocked the building first thing every morning, and we were open from 7 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night to the whole public. They make sure things are set up for the services. We had a daily round of 3 services every day, not counting weekends. 21 regularly scheduled services a week, and about 150 special services of various sorts during the year. They helped the altar guild, they helped the sound system, they made all of that work, and they were professionals, and they knew the liturgy, and they knew the prayer book, and they knew how to fix things, and they knew how to sweep floors. They did all of it, and directed the sextons. And one of them, Gregory, who, as soon as I met him, I thought, you know, I think he's gay. No, I didn't say, that guy's gay. And he came in my office about the third day and plopped down on my desk a book called Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin. And he said, you need to understand what it's like to be here in San Francisco, and you read this and then you'll know. And then we'll talk. And so I brought it home. I said, I don't know about this. So Cherry said, well, you never read that part of the newspaper. This is a famous novel about gay life in San Francisco. And so I sort of...
It was being serialized in the paper.
Well, but this volume had already been written, but because the next volume was being serialized, yes. So so I started, and and the main character, Michael, was preparing for Halloween, which in San Francisco is like you've never seen. He was preparing his resolutions for Halloween. And one of them was that I will ease my way back into religion by attending concerts at Grace Cathedral. And the next one was, I will not cruise men at Grace Cathedral. We found ourselves in a congregation that didn't do don't ask, don't tell, celebrated the fact that they were gay and lesbian members along with the majority who were straight, in a welcoming congregation. I thought, well, this is going to really be nice, and we'll have a place, we'll be in a place where we did not have ordained women on the cathedral staff yet, but we knew we were going to because we were a diocese that welcomed the ministry of women. In fact, a previous bishop of California named James Pike actually broke the law and ordained a woman to the diaconate in the 60s, which just caused enormous uproar in the Episcopal Church, because they were really, the southern bishops were pissed off at Bishop Pike for supporting civil rights, and since he also wrote theology you could question and now was breaking the canons, they didn't have to go after him for supporting civil rights, so they go after him for those things. But that's another matter, and we're past that. But anyhow, so there we were, that looked good. And then one of our members, a priest who was had resigned his job working for the bishop because of ill health, died of cancer, and it was sort of not talked about. And I didn't know the man much. This was just a few months after we got there, but I realized that there was something about this. And very soon after, one of our new members, brand new, he'd grown up in the Episcopal Church and been away for a while, a gay member, on one Sunday had a really ugly purplish blotch that had shown up right there. Andrew. And this was by the end of 82. By 83, middle of 83, thousands of men in San Francisco were sick. significant number were our congregation members. We also had men coming to us to worship with us who had been away from church for a long time, and they were sick, or their partner was sick, and they wanted some church after all, even though they'd been savaged by it, and were hearing that we would welcome them gladly. And this was a hard time. Cherry and I lost 110 friends. And blessed things happened. Blessed things happened. God spoke through his people. We said, we're not going to give in to this. We're going to affirm people. We're going to support people. About that time, the dean who'd hired me got fired because he was plagiarizing his sermons from William Sloan Coffin and made the mistake of recommending a book of sermons by William Sloan Coffin, who had been his seminary classmate, and said, you ought to read these. And then one of our parishioners did and discovered that the last four sermons the dean had preached and printed with his name on them were directly from that book. And, that didn't go well. And here am I, 40, just turned 40, still trying to find my footing after 2 years there. The bishop said, will you be the acting dean? Okay, and then about that time, had a phone call from the pastor at St. Francis Lutheran Church, a gay-friendly Lutheran church in San Francisco, saying, we need to do something about AIDS, and I think, first of all, we need to pray for healing for people who are living with it and threatened by it. And the cathedral is the most public and pronounced building in the city. The only other one that come close would be St. Mary Bendix, the Roman Catholic cathedral that looks like the agitator on a washing machine. Or St. Mary Maytag, pardon me. They've called it also the Archbishop's Bendix or St. Mary Maytag, and they won't let gay people in. Well, there are a lot of gay people there, but they won't talk about it. So the Grace is the place. And we said, let's have a public interfaith service of healing. And we had, and we simply sent out word to clergy in San Francisco, and we had Methodists and Presbyterians and Lutherans and Roman Catholics, in spite of the Archbishop, and Jews, and Unitarians, and Muslims, and even the Wiccans, which was a little, how do you deal with that? Who said, we want to be part of it. And we had these, started doing that, and after the first one, people said, we have to do this again. And once a month then, for the next 5 years, these incredibly moving times of prayer. We then, from that, developed an AIDS Day of Remembrance, once they set National AIDS Day, when for a weekend the cathedral will give over its whole space to this. We had artists who came and did installations of artwork. The quilt project was going on. Our congregation members were building quilts. I remember when I went to the General Convention in 1985. A friend of mine and I, we were going to have the Episcopal Church by this time. I'm getting ahead of stuff, but it was announced that part of the quilt would be on display in the conference in the convention center where we were having our thing. And during lunch break, a friend of mine and I went down to see the quilt, and we started walking around finding quilt pieces from people we knew and loved. And there was my bishop, Bill Swing, standing in one spot and tears rolling down his cheeks because there was a four-piece quilt showing the bay and the Golden Gate Bridge, and the bay had some white caps on the water, and the sky, blue sky behind the bridge, had some white clouds, and there were names of the members of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus who were gone there. And moving thing. And so, our bishop said, we've got to do something about this. This is wrong. The Episcopal Church has to not just simply quietly do something about this, because we were encountering person after person whose family back in wherever he had moved from would not even speak to him, who would not come out there when he was near death in the hospital, or else would come and whisk him away overnight while refusing to let his partner who'd been caring for him even come in the hospital room. Or other people we would say we haven't seen, and we'd find they were gone. And the Episcopal Church has to rise to this. And we did. And the Episcopal Church, along with Grace Cathedral, sponsored a national conference on ministry in the time of the HIV/AIDS crisis in 1989 at the cathedral, and drew several hundred people, and the presiding bishop and bishops from all over the country. We had bishops who were there who were anti-gay, who ended up on their knees in tears, embracing people with Kaposi's sarcoma there. And the Episcopal Church began to say, maybe we need to come out of the closet and recognize that our church is a church that has a space in it for gay and lesbian people. And that was an important time, and it pissed off some people too.
Michael, may I ask a question?
Please, Terry Roper, because you were here too.
In the sequence of things, I don't think it was 89. I think it was earlier. But Grace Cathedral...
Maybe it was 87.
I don't know quite what it was. The Grace Cathedral put on an absolutely superb conference on AIDS.
That's right. I know you were there. So did Howard Ross.
Very important. What mm-hmm. year was that?
I think that... I was thinking that was 89, but maybe it was 87. It may have been 87. It may have been before that general convention. Well, you know what it was like, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Yes.
It was just amazing. Even Armistead Maupin, who wrote that book, spoke, and he didn't like church at all. And Gregory, that verger, said, he went over and introduced himself. He said, in volume two, you describe going up in the catwalks, and you don't have that correct. And so he made him go up there and gave him a tour of the catwalks. No, he said there was a spiral staircase up into the catwalks, and there wasn't.
But he also got the key wrong.
Yes, that's right, too.
Father Irwin, can you tell the story that you told at GLF brunch about communion and the bishop?
Yes. We had, even in the congregation, we had people legitimately, and from all over the country, worried about catching AIDS. It was scary, right? And what does the Episcopal Church do but invite everybody to drink out of the same cup? And we had people in our congregation particularly who actually knew there were people there. They could point. They knew them who had AIDS, and they were worried about what they were going to do. And people in the other congregations were too, and as well as bishops, the House of Bishops, saying to each other, what shall we do? And Bishop Swing had a contact at the Center for Disease Control, and contacted him and said, what do you think? And this is when the U.S. government, as before Rock Hudson got AIDS and President Reagan changed his tune about AIDS. So the government wasn't doing much, but the CDC then investigated and tested and wrote back and said, we found that the HIV virus is a very, in itself, weak virus. And exposure both to the alcohol in the wine and into the silver of the cups. They said, by the way, use silver cups. The AIDS virus can't survive in that, and it's safe. Well, how people are about what scientists say. Even in those days, some people didn't believe science, thought it was fake news. And so Bishop Mason announced, Swing announced, all right, from here on out, at every Eucharist from now on, I will not receive communion from the chalice until after everybody else in the building have drunk from the chalice, and then I will consume all that remains. It was wonderful. We started talking about recognizing. We saw couples, gay couples and lesbian couples, whose devotion to each other was as firm as any marriage we had ever seen. How those two women from up in the North Bay, from Saratoga, another Episcopal diocese, a much more less welcoming one, they had been together for almost 50 years. And one of them had been the parish treasurer for about 15 years, and the other was the head of the altar guild, and everybody loved him. And they got a new priest, and he said, if you keep living together, then we have to assume you're having sex, and therefore you have to either separate or leave your parish leadership positions. So they came back down to San Francisco, and they were, by the way, in that time when the mayor of San Francisco legalized gay marriage for a time before Proposition 8 stopped it again, they were the very first two people married at City Hall in their 55th year of marriage. And lots of others. I mean, you know, I'm talking about people celebrating their 55th anniversary of love to each other, who fell in love in the Second World War, fighting for their nation, died from AIDS with an American flag over their coffin because they were part of the greatest generation. And the Episcopal Church just said, how can we honor that if we say you can't get married? What is it about your relationship that says you can't be married? We wrote, our liturgical commission of the diocese was commissioned by the bishop to compose a marriage liturgy, and we did. And he said, I cannot approve that officially. And that's all he said. And then, so officially he didn't approve it. Good. Finally, a few years ago, things really changed. But I didn't do anything except happen to fall into it. But Cherry and I, the day came when Andrew, our dear Andrew, who was the first person we saw with Kaposi's sarcoma, Andrew was in the very first cohort in San Francisco. If you've ever heard of a book called And the Band Played On by Randy Schilt about the first 10 years of the AIDS epidemic in San Francisco, he tells about early on in it, a jury impaneled in the San Francisco court. The jurors realized that one in their group, Andrew, it turns out it was Andrew, one in their, though it didn't say that in the book, had AIDS, and they asked the judge to dismiss him so they wouldn't be in danger of catching AIDS. And that was Andrew. Andrew lived longer than anybody else in that first cohort studied, till 1983.
Because he drank at least a gallon of wine
a day. A bad wine.
And smoked, I don't know how many cigarettes.
Two packs of ultra-long Marlboros, and I remember sitting out, taking him when he was in a wheelchair in the hospital, taking him out in his wheelchair to a stairwell outside where he could, and then going back and getting his, what was that really awful Chablis? Awful, horrible Chablis and his cigarettes. And we were sitting out there and he was smoking and drinking cheap wine, and his doctor came out and said, oh hell, we're in trouble now. You've caught me giving him cigarettes and alcohol. And the doctor said, look, we have no idea why he's still alive. We're not trying to get him to change anything. But that was our Andrew. But I went to another one of those liturgical conferences in Seattle at St. Paul's, where a 12-year-old girl in their parish, St. Paul's was a friendly parish too, and a 12-year-old girl in their parish had learned about the Japanese folding origami cranes and she had folded 1,000 in memory of the men in their parish who died of AIDS. And I said, what a cool thing. I came home and told I got home and there were Cherry and Andrew with a cheap bottle of Carlo Rossi. That's what it was, Chablis.
You sprung that on me when we were sailing in the middle of the
night. Or that's what it was.
You either agree or you swim back.
No. And anyhow, I remember it differently. But Cherry and Andrew said, okay, by that point, almost 50,000 people had died of AIDS. And they said, let's get our congregation to fold 50,000 cranes and hang them in the cathedral for the next AIDS Day of Remembrance. And they set out to do it, and they accomplished it. And it was... congregation members would sit there during the sermon tearing up their service bulletin and folding it into cranes, you know. And it was a beautiful time. Oh yeah, prisoners at San Quentin sent us a big box of cranes. Girl Scout troops, Brownie troops, people from Sweden who were tourists walked through. The Japanese consulate sent a whole pile of them. It was sort of cool. We
one
in the midst.
Georgia sent me a letter and said, "Can you send me a picture of my crane? It's the yellow one."
But I've got to go in and do a sermon now. But the why I tell so much of this is it was one of the things that led the Episcopal Church from grudgingly trying to be open and welcoming to just say, "All right, folks." This is true of most of the Episcopal Church. There are islands in the Episcopal Church that still are not comfortable with that. And you and I live in such an island, but we happen to live in an archipelago within that island that has said we're with the Episcopal Church first. Diocese of Dallas, of course, but we're with the Episcopal Church. And that it was an important time in the life of our church. Isn't it interesting, something like that? Because it loosened up a lot of other things. The last resistance to women, except in a few places, happened. And of course, as you know, some of the places most uptight just picked up their bags and walked and claimed to be the true Episcopal Church. And said, "We won't play with your marbles any longer. You can't play with ours." But sometimes we feel like we're a minority, but we are with 95 at least, if not more, percent of the Episcopal Church, my friends. And it wasn't AIDS alone that did that. It was women's ordination. It was above all a new prayer book that said baptism is central to the life of the church and every baptized person is a full member of the body of Christ, regardless of anything else. All of those things came about. And it's been a blessed time. I don't know if I have much else to say next week, but I'll try to sum up a few things and hear from you. Okay? So I need to go preach.